All right, here we go again. We're on marriage is a licensed business. And anytime you get a license, you're engaged in some kind of an illegal activity, because a license by definition is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So what is family law all about? Well, family law is that body of law that is regulated under the marriage license. And there are courts that just deal with family law. We call them divorce courts, but they're typically called family courts. And they deal with such things as the guardian-ward relationship, parents, patre, custody standards, custody, marriage, divorce, separation, alimony, child support. But there are literally thousands of laws that regulate this industry called marriage. For instance, you have to have your children immunized in order to send them to public school. They have to be sent to public school because we have compulsory education laws. And these laws are enacted by the legislature in conformance to, or a part of, or as a part of the marriage business. There was a time in marriage in America when we didn't have marriage licenses. Prior to 1876, when Illinois became the first state to start issuing marriage licenses on a large scale, general application for marriage licenses, even as far back as 1900, you know, just 25 years later, marriage licenses were not common. But by 1920, they were common. By 1940, they're practically universal. Today, if somebody is married without a marriage license, people kind of look at them with tongue in cheek and say, oh my God, that's a common law marriage. Or they're just living together, or they're shacked up, or they don't have a real marriage. Well, going back in time, did we have real marriages when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were running around on the planet, or were all of their marriages just funny marriages and their children were all bastards because, after all, they weren't married? Where would Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Daniel, or any of those people have gone to get a marriage license? Well, they would have gone to the king. They'd have gone to the state. Marriage licenses aren't something new. They're new in Anglo-Saxon administration, but they're not new in pagan mythology, ideology, government, politics, or religion. You know, the ancient Babylonians and Egyptians and Sumerians all went to the king to get permission to marry, because marriage is a business. It's a family business, to be sure, but it's a business. And today, it's big business, and it's regulated by the state. Now, this marriage is a three-party limited general partnership. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. It's by, for, and among, and between all three of these parties. And the marriage license is proof of that contract. A common law marriage is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl. It's by, for, among, and between the two parties. There may be or there may not be a formal written instrument as proof of the contract. The agreement to contract is by penetration, that's consensual sexual intercourse, and agreement. It is not universally recognized, and where it is recognized, such as in Texas, the states assume jurisdiction by way of birth certificates. And when it's recognized by the state, there is very little difference between a common law marriage and a civil law marriage. Now, a patriarchal marriage, which comes from the scripture, is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl's father. The female is not a contracting party. The contract is for a limited purpose, and that is of transferring guardianship of the female from the father to the husband. The girl's father gives away his daughter in a public ceremony. The contract terminates upon consummation. The consummation is the proof of the marriage. And upon consummation, the boy accepts all of the liabilities of the girl's father. And under Hebrew law, the females must be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. So the female is a liability which is transferred to the husband. The female is the object of the contract, not a contracting party. Kind of a wild new concept, isn't it? Now, there are various standards for custody. Custody. And custody is predicated upon the doctrine of parens patriae. So let's take a look at who owns this child. So let me make this statement. No female on planet Earth in the entire history of mankind has ever owned a child. Let me repeat that. No female on this planet has ever owned a child. No female on this planet is ever going to own a child. And that's because fathers can own children and states can own children. That is, the king can own your child, mother, or your husband can own your child, but you can't. Now, in America today, neither the father or mother own the child. The state owns the child, and it comes under the doctrine of parens patriae. Now, the origin of the doctrine of parens patriae in the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in the maintaining of the structure of feudalism. Chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties, and the concept of parens patriae was usually invoked in connection with problems of property or guardianship. Now, in some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Now, who determines whether a parent is undeserving? Well, Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust, and that it does so because parents usually discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. Again, who decides who an unfit parent is? Oh, that's done by the state. Now, the right of parental control is a natural but not an unalienable one, and in the trust referred to by Lord Redesdale, the settlor, or the creator of the trust, is the state. The trustee is presumably the child's natural parents, and the beneficiary of the trust, or the sesticui trust, is called the minor child. The fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals, but they may not criticize these standards on the grounds that the parents are a specific child's parents and that they know what is best for their own child. You know, mothers and daddies, the concept that you know what's best for your child resides with the state, not with you. And the reason that the state comes in and determines these kinds of facts is because you have a marriage license in which you invited the state into your marriage as a third party. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. So you have a three-party limited general partnership in which the state is a one-third party and has a one-third property right or interest in the profits that are generated by the family, by the marriage. So when mom and dad get married with a state marriage license, and then mom and dad produce children, motorcycles, snow machines, condominiums, houses, businesses, property. When dad dies, mama says, oh, goody, I get all the toys. And the state comes in and says, oh no, mommy, buy me out. So what does buy me out mean? It means pay the inheritance tax, mommy. Because, you see, there's three of us involved in this partnership, and now the partnership has been dissolved by the death or by the divorce of one of the parties. Therefore, pay me. So the state comes in and regulates the custody for which there are 12 custody standards. You see, parens patriae is created by the state, and then the state comes up and says, okay, now we're going to develop these standards by which the state will determine custody. Isn't that just real special? I knew you'd love it. Now, when we talk about custody, then we're talking about 12 standards that the state develops to make a determination as to who should have this child. Who should have custody of the child, the mother or the father? Now, when the state comes in and makes that determination, they make it in the child's best interest. Or do they make it in the state's best interest and call it the child's best interest because it sounds better for public relations? In any event, the following is a list of the 12 items a family court judge will look for when determining a person's fitness to have physical and or legal custody of a minor child. These are not put in any specific order, as each court, indeed each judge, will weigh these differently. And also some courts and or judges will have additional items which they may use. However, we know of no family court that doesn't start with these 12 items. Number one is called the moral character. Usually the judge will consider the moral character of all those seeking custody as well as any individuals with whom they live. Two, financial ability. This is used to determine a party's ability to provide a financially stable environment. During divorces, the wife's financial ability is based on, or at least in part, just how much money can she expect to be paid by her husband in alimony and child support. So when this issue comes up, like financial ability, you know, if you stop and think about it for a moment, you know, men actually have the better financial ability to support the child than do mothers. Ah, well then why is it that mothers get custody 96.5% of the time and fathers 3.5% of the time? Well, that's because the state is really the father, and the father is a eunuch, and the state comes in and says, here's who I want to raise my child. And so the state, who owns the child by way of the birth certificate, had a one-third interest with the marriage license, and when you got the birth certificate, you and your wife gave 100% of the child to the state. And you did that for a benefit. Remember, under Wickard versus Filburn, you wanted to be able to collect food stamps, welfare, and send your child to free public school, free public education. That's just three of the many benefits that you receive from the state as a partner with the state in your family business. Isn't that real neat? So now the state comes in under Wickard versus Filburn and they regulate the terms and conditions of this marriage. And they regulate it because, after all, they own it, don't they? Number three, parental affection. Number four, child rearing skills. Number five, child training skills. Number six, the best interests of the child. And then the ability to provide the necessities of life. This goes beyond mere financial ability to cover those items which cannot be quantified financially. A person with lots of money who can't be bothered to buy good shoes for their child may pass the financial ability test but fail this one. Formal education. In contested issues of custody, the general rule is that all other items being equal, the more educated a party is, the better their chances of keeping or getting custody. So those of you that have a PhD, or you have a master's degree, or you have a college degree, just picture this, Daddy. You've got a master's degree in business administration, you're financially able, and the mother, in this case, maybe is a high school graduate or a high school dropout, and there's a contested issue over custody, and that is you want custody of the child. Hey, listen, all things being equal, you got a better shot at getting custody than does the mother. And I don't care, from my point of view here at the law school, whether you're male or female. Everybody has a constitutional right to the child. That's right, a constitutional right to that child. That means that you fathers have a 50-50 shot at getting the child if you only knew how. And what about child support? Oh, that's a big issue. I get asked that quite often. Well, child support is a requirement both of the civil law and the common law. It goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. You have a duty to support your child there, daddies. Well, if you're going to support your child, why don't you take custody of your child? And then, of course, there's playmates, and then the history of child abuse. So if you're a child abuser over here, you don't have a very good chance of coming out of here with the child. Or if you have a history of child neglect, well, that'll work against you. All right. Now, when it comes to custody, that is the custody item itself, then who is it who's entitled to taking custody, or what determines custody, for instance, in Pennsylvania? Well, in making an award of custody between parents, the court must consider the best interests of the children. Overnight visitation is called partial custody. Any custody order is reviewable upon any change of circumstances. You know, you could call up a new custody hearing 12 times a year. If there's 12 changes in custody or in the circumstances of custody, in addition to that, you can call it up once per year for the entire life of the child until the child reaches 18. So this custody is reviewable every year, daddies. And a child's desires with regard to custody and parental custody are given more weight as the child gets older. Until age 12, such desires have very little weight. Third parties can obtain custody very rarely. Grandparents have a right to visitation that is statutorily guaranteed in some situations, and particularly where their child, the parent of their grandchildren, has died or is separated from the grandchildren's other parent. Did you know that you grandparents also have rights in many states, or in most states, as a matter of fact? And there are such things as contempt of a custody order. You know, if your spouse is in contempt of a custody order, you can have the custody order modified and have parental custody terminated. Termination of parental rights. And then grandparents and custodial rights come into play. And the custody generally. You know, custody embraces the sum of parental rights with respect to the rearing of a child, including his care. And it includes the right to the child's services and earnings, and the right to direct his activities and to make decisions regarding his care and control, education, health, and religion. The legal custody of a minor is in the parent's or the surviving parent, unless there's been a court adjudication awarding custody to a third person. Now let's take a look at the guardian-ward relationship. You know, there's a guardian-ward relationship that comes into play with the state, the mommy, and the daddy. And this guardian-ward relationship is called a trust relationship. Listen to this. Did you know that a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character? Sacred, sacred. Hey, that's kind of religious, isn't it? In which one person who is called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. Now, you know, when custody is taken away from you, whether you're a mother or a father, do you know that the state then is acting in a guardian ward relationship between you and the state and is taking the guardianship away from you and the child, or the control of the child away from you? In a guardian-ward relationship, they view you as being a ward of the state. Have you ever thought of yourself as being a ward, incapable of managing your own affairs, incapable of raising or rearing your own child? Well, that's what it boils down to. Now, a curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person, and in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. He has the same powers and obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that in effect, he is a guardian of the estate. Now, the purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the court should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. So what you do is you go out and get a marriage license and create a three-party limited general partnership. Then you have children. As a member of the three-party limited general partnership, the state is the superior partner and gives custody to mommy and daddy, or in the event of a divorce of mommy and daddy, gives custody to one of the surviving parents as it deems best in the child's best interest. That's a guardian ward relationship in which, when you get a marriage license and have a child, you become the state's babysitter over the state's child, and you can raise the state's child in the state's school, educate the state's the child in the state's humanist religion. And if you decide that you don't want to do any of the above, then you're subject to having new babysitters appointed. That's called termination of parental rights. About 2.5 million children a year are taken out of their homes and placed in foster care because the state is dissatisfied with mommy and daddy and wants to change babysitter. So if you're a mother or father and you have children with a marriage license and a birth certificate, you, as a matter of law, are an officer of the court, a guardian over the child, and your guardianship over the child is subject to replacement by a new babysitter if the state decides that they're not satisfied with your guardianship. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, the appointment of a conservator works like this. In several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he's incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, request, or simply consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate or of his person or both, and that's the marriage license, and who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. So when you get a marriage license, you declare yourself to be incompetent, unable to manage a family. I mean, after all, you may become unemployed one of these days, and you won't be able to feed, clothe, and house your family, and so therefore, you're going to need the benefits of the state, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, or something of the like. You want to avail yourself of the safety net, do you not? All Americans do. Most Americans have. Now, what would happen if you decided that you would like to determine whether or not your child has immunization? How would it be if you decided on your child's school? Well, did you know that every state in the union makes provisions for an exemption to immunization, save for two, Mississippi and West Virginia, and homeschool by all 50 states, and that you can educate your child at home, or in a parochial school, or in public school, and that you can choose if you just knew how to use the family law of your state to accomplish that goal. Same thing is true with immunization. You see, immunization violates the scripture. And any time that there is a law that violates the scripture, then God comes in and creates a waiver for those people who want to obey God and keep his commandments. So, except for Mississippi and West Virginia, which you'll have to get a court order. So in school, I'll teach you how to get a court order. Or if you're in Missouri, there's a waiver, and if you're in California, you can object on just personal moral grounds. Just personal moral grounds. And there's an objection, and if you'll put in your objection, take the waiver, you can avoid or prohibit or prevent immunization or public school. Now remember, this comes under Wickard versus Filburn. The government regulates and controls that which it subsidizes. What would happen if you wanted to get married and you didn't want any government subsidies? Hey, did you know that you could have a baby, you could have a marriage, and you can function in American society as a common law free man without government intervention? That's a wild new concept that we make available and explain in detail here in the Family Law School. Family Law. For more information, just call the school. It's 317-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. Click onto the email and send me an email request, and we'll give you more information about Family law. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come back and take up the next subject, which will be the Civil Rights Act, Title 42, Section 1983.